So I give this course on Hasidism and modernity, and in fact that is where your esteemed program organizer, Mrs. Tika
Conway,
that's right, she was a student of mine at some point, and so that gave her the idea of asking me to give this talk tonight, and we settled on something which is actually the title of that course. Now, in one of the pages that you've just been given, there is a diagram of Hasidic dynasties. And you see here, this is filched right from my Hasidism and Modernity course, as you can see. So the vertical is like generations. We have the Baal Shem Tov, and other colleagues, associates of him, like Rabbi Pinchas of Koretz. This is a heavily Eastern European map with, through the generations, his disciple, Rabbi Dov Ber, the Magen Mezerich, died in 1772, and then a series of disciples, and they come down through to a list of names at the bottom, Rizhin, Vizhnitz, Bel, Satma, Bobov, Gur, Lubavitch, Braslav. Those are all contemporary Hasidic communities in London N16. I haven't adapted it for Northwest London. There may be one or two more who are specifically in Northwest London, I'm not sure. And some of these groups have a parallel group here in Northwest London as well. For example, Ger and Lubavitch certainly do, and I'm not quite sure about the others. Now that's one aspect of Hasidism. That's the photographical dimension of Hasidism. People who wear traditional clothes, they're thought of as a specific community. What I want to look at is the ethos of Hasidism. And I want to try to see ways in which this ethos might be relevant to any Jew. In fact, in some ways, to a non-Jew as well. But the ethos of Hasidism as meaning something for us in terms of the question of what is the role of man in the modern age. Now, the modern age is something very interesting, and we're going to be discussing a little bit what is the nature of modernity in a moment. Now, if you look back at the other page of the handout, which is the actual talk that we've got for this evening, I'm starting as I do in my university course at UCL. Professor Joseph Dan. Now, Professor Joseph Dan, I know him quite well. I remember when I was a student at the Hebrew University for a short time while I was studying at UCL, as we still do send students to Hebrew University. So I was also one of those who went. And I remember taking courses with Professor Joseph Dan. He wasn't professor then, he was a younger man. Very interesting person. He then occupied the chair of Jewish mysticism in the Hebrew University. I think it was in 1988, there was a conference here in London organized by my colleague Ada Rappaport-Alba. And she organized a conference in which he gave a talk. It was a public talk. It was crowded public lecture. And his question was Hasidism, the third century. And he raised the question, how is it that Hasidism has survived? Now, he's asking that question in a very straightforward way. When we look at this chain of Hasidic dynasties, in a way, we're looking at the shtetl. This is the Hasidic shtetl. I mean, all these names, Rizhin, Vizhnitz, Bel, Satmar, I've been to some of these places. They're tiny little places. I've been to Lubavitch, I've been to Gora Kawaria, which is Gur. They are tiny little places. And that was the atmosphere where Hasidism was nurtured in this sort of spiritual Eastern European context. So that's what was happening in the late 1700s, early 1800s, 1820, 1830. You take the shtetl phenomenon. First of all, just the process leading around the time of the First World War, when a lot of people moved out of the shtetlach into Warsaw. And suddenly in the big city, you walk down the street, there's Rizhin, there's Vizhnitz, there's Gur, there's Bobov. They were all there in the city somehow, crowded against each other. And then you have all the intensity of what happened in the interwar years between the First World War and the Second World War. And then Rachman Litzlan, the terrible tragedy of the Holocaust striking most intimately at Eastern European Jewry. And then you have further transformations. Thank God, the creation of the modern state of Israel. But for all intents and purposes, it looks like, for many people, other people don't see it that way, it looks like a secular state, a secular environment. How are these shtetl phenomena going to continue? That's what Joseph Dan was asking. But quite, it's a published article, published in the book, Hasidism Reappraised, and it seems a very pertinent question. And then he says, but it's quite remarkable. They do exist. They're there. They're there. They're in Israel. They're in America. They're in London. They're here. They're there. They have often a controversial role in Israeli politics, but they exist. So he's asking the question, how come they exist? We are asking a further question. What difference does it make to us in the sense of the normal Jew of the 21st century, whether we're living in London or wherever we are, maybe traveling all over the world for business or pleasure or meeting our relatives? What difference does Hasidism make? Is it relevant in any way whatsoever? Okay, so now let's try to look for a moment at the whole concept of modernity. We've got the idea of Hasidism and modernity. Excuse the sometimes varied spellings over here. Hasidism sometimes has three S's and sometimes only two S's. All right, the spell check didn't pick it up. Now let's have a look at modernity. Modernity, what exactly does modernity mean? I'm going to move. I mean, we're all aware one aspect of modernity. My dear late professor, Shimon Abramsky, he would very often begin a lecture saying, when did modernity begin? What's the beginning of modernity? And, was it the French Revolution? Was it this? Was it that? Was it the Enlightenment? Was it Voltaire? So we've got all kinds of concepts. Rationality, the idea of reason versus tradition. Reason versus faith, right? Faith and reason, that's the polarity around which you could see modernity as circling around that polarity. Reason or revelation, right? That's one of the ways of putting it. The Enlightenment, Aufklärung. The Enlightenment, where suddenly the light of reason is shone on the superstition of tradition. That's the way the Enlighteners look at it. But on the other hand, we've got emancipation, we've got freedom. The idea that the freedom, whether it's the freedom of the peasants in France, the freedom of the serfs, the freedom, emancipation, and certainly the emancipation of the Jew. It used to be that a Jew traveling in Germany, if he was traveling into a town, if he was allowed to go into that town, would be a whole question. And if he was allowed into the town, then someone would come and charge Leibzoll, body tax. There was a tax on cattle and there was a tax on Jews. And the Jew had to pay Leibzoll, person, body tax, in order to get into a town. Well, thank God, there came emancipation, there came freedom, there came education. Now, education is a very interesting issue. Is education freedom to be educated? Is it being imposed? Is the education being imposed? But this is the stuff of modernity and personal freedom. It all sounds good. Do you agree? Does it sound good? Modernity sounds good, yes? If you think it sounds good, put up one. This is a classroom technique. If you think it sounds good, put up one finger. But if you think it sounds bad, put up five fingers. That's a way to get everyone's... So one finger means modernity is good, and five fingers means it's bad. All right, everyone seems to think modernity is good. Okay, that's beautiful. That's wonderful. Anyone think it's bad? No, you do. Okay, fine, all right. Well, I'm going to look at another book, which I also use in my UCL class. Max Weber, he wrote a very famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. He describes what's the real step which makes it modern as opposed to pre-modern. He does it in a very interesting way. Brilliant writer. He says, it's nothing to do with mechanization. That's not what makes it modern. You could have factories or you don't have factories. That's not the issue of modernity. He describes a scene where there is a person who is a wholesaler of cloth, right? He's living somewhere in Bavaria, let's say. He's a wholesaler of cloth. His father was a wholesaler of cloth, and his father before him. Now, how does he make the cloth? There are various farmers, sheep farmers, who come to him and they bring their wool. There are various people who are weavers and they weave the wool. And this person, he might still be a medieval man, but he is connecting together the wool coming from this place, the weavers from over here. He's putting it all together. He's producing these wholesale bales of nice woven woolen cloth, and he's selling them to someone or other. Now, his father dealt with the fathers of the people who produce the wool and with the fathers of the weavers and sold to the fathers of the people who buy the cloth from him. It's a traditional business. It's been going on for generations. My grandfather bought from your grandfather, sold to his grandfather, down last generation, my father did the same, and then suddenly my generation is making the step towards modernity. I don't want to buy wool from you. I can get it cheaper from someone else. I'm not going to use you as a weaver because there's a cheaper weaver over there. I'm not going to sell the cloth to you because I can make more profit by selling it to that guy. Suddenly, as he puts it, it works very well in both English and German. Brothers become others. Bruder and oder. So the brother, the person who was a brother, who was a person, not necessarily physically a brother, but we were brothers in that our grandparents dealt together. Suddenly, forget it, no profit motive. Time is money, and a whole different way of looking at the world. And what this can be described as, if we are trying to look for spiritual values, we can say that this is a secularization of human relationships. Human relationships, when it was my grandfather dealing with all these other grandfathers, and me feeling that I'm at the end of that chain and we've got this connection together and we are concerned for each other. We are not concerned at making the extra coin. We're concerned that there is a relationship here. Suddenly the extra coin becomes the issue and brothers become others. That's the step of modernity. Translate that into terms of greater mechanization and factories and different kinds of social organization, and you have a situation where one's own self becomes the other. This French word, déraciné, uprooted. People feel uprooted from one's own origin, their own self, their own being. Who are they? Who is anyone else? Loneliness. Loneliness as a philosophy, as a atmosphere, very fruitful for creating interesting art, music, and philosophy. The whole concept of modern art and modern music is really an expression of the pain which comes out of this kind of déraciné atmosphere. Okay, so that's wie es kristaltet sich. Heinrich Heine said, wie es kristaltet sich, the way that he was making up these words, the way that the Christian world behaves, also judeltet sich, that's how the Jewish world behaves. So we get reflections of this in the Jewish world, and we have reactions in order to preserve the traditionality and the meaning and the importance, the significance, the wholesomeness of Judaism. So one way of understanding that, a very crucial way, is number three, the battle to preserve orthodoxy. Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, he is concerned to preserve orthodoxy. This actually began in the battle with Reform around 1818. Reform set up a temple in Hamburg, and as a result, the Hamburg Beisdin called for responses by Orthodox rabbis to try to protect the halakha. And out of that, Reb Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, became a leading light in the whole idea of preserving orthodoxy. He is the author of the famous slogan, Chodosh Osur Min HaTorah. Now that is really a technical term from the Mishnah about the new grain, and the grain which has been grown or reaped after Pesach, and it didn't go through the first day, the first 2 days of Pesach, when there was the idea of bringing the Omer, or it's the grain that was reaped before Pesach and the idea of not eating it before Pesach. So that is the new grain, which is forbidden. And there's a question, is it from the rabbis or from the Torah? So he applied this to synagogue practice, the way in which a synagogue was built, the atmosphere of Judaism, the halakha, Chodosh Osur Min HaTorah, the new things are forbidden by the Torah, and it became a famous slogan, protecting orthodoxy, preserving the halakha. When he passed away, he had written a will, a tzavor, for his own children, and the will expressed his ethos in an even more intense way. And that will, the tzavor of the Chatam Sofer, became the basis of Haredi orthodoxy, preserving not only the main chapter headings, but the small print of the halakha as well. And that's how we get the whole concept of Haredi orthodoxy in Eastern Europe and now in various parts of the world, where not only the basic lines of the halakha, but also certain concepts of minhag, of custom, of clothing, of beards, and this, that, the other, all the small print. Now, so that's a process which is taking place as a reaction to the process of deracination, brothers become others, secularization. So there's a secularizing process and there's a battle to preserve orthodoxy. Okay, now that is taking place. That is a historical process which is there. Now let's try to look a little bit critically at this process. There are two aspects of Jewish life. This is number four. The letter and the spirit. There's the letter we have in English law. The letter of the law and the spirit of the law. People speak about the giving of the Torah as giving us that image itself. At the giving of the Torah, we have the actual commands, Ten Commandments. Do not steal. Do not commit adultery. Laws. Moshe went up Mount Sinai, received the entire Torah, all the Tariyag Mitzvah. But that's complemented by something else. The drama of Mount Sinai. The thunder, the lightning, the sound of the shofar, things that everyone was able to experience. And then what the Chumash tells us about Moses' experience on Mount Sinai in Ki Tissa, particularly talking about him trying to ask God for the repentance of the Jewish people, for the forgiveness of the Jewish people. And there's this close relationship between Moses and the divine. Moses says to God, Hareini na es drachecha, show me your ways. There's this tremendous intimacy with the divine. That's somehow in a different compartment. There's the halacha, there's keeping the laws, honoring your parents, keeping Shabbat, not taking God's name in vain. And then there are these spiritual, intense relationships with God, which are being described, which for the whole Jewish people, it was the most incredible thing, and described in all kinds of ways in Talmudic thought. And when we come down the generations, first of all, in the time of the temple, the first temple, we have the clear, intense atmosphere of the Nevi'im, the prophets. We read that occasionally for a Haftorah or people studying Tanakh in itself, Nach, Nevi'im. It's beautifully inspiring the way that the different prophets, Eliyahu Hanavi, Elisha Hanavi, the way in which the prophets would inspire the people, often in very, very difficult circumstances. For example, Elijah on Mount Carmel, where there's a kind of a contest between the priests of Baal and Elijah, who is the priest of God. And the result of the contest, everyone shouted out, Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem is God, which we declare at the closing moments of Yom Kippur. It's an intense moment of recognition of the divine. Now, in the Talmud, this parity, this complementarity, you could say, the idea that we have the letter on the one hand and the spirit on the other, they are balanced in the Talmud in a most wonderful, wonderful way. I see here beautifully on your lovely shelves a number of different editions of the Talmud. Steinsaltz, the Art Scrolls, Sansina, beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Now in the Talmud, and Hebrew volume, now in the Talmud, we have halacha and agadah. We have the actual laws and discussion of the laws, very, very specific issues and going into all kinds of details about the halacha. And we also have agadic passages. The agadic passages might be telling us a story about some great man or about King David or one of the rabbis of the Talmud, or it might be giving an interpretation of a verse or of a string of verses. The agada in the Talmud is intended, I think we can justifiably say, it's intended by the editor of the Talmud, the main editor, Rav Ashi, it's intended to be inspiring. There's the halakha, which is also inspiring. The halakha is also a very inspiring dimension. But it's inspiring in understanding the detail, understanding all the different issues involved. The Agadah is inspiring because it's talking about one's relationship with God. Edifying stories, edifying ideas, inspiration. So how do we get these two aspects of Jewish life, given that we are now in a kind of conflict situation? There's modernity and secularization on the one hand, with all its positive aspects. We don't want to throw modernity out of the window. It's just got a few problems. So we've got modernity on the one hand, and on the other hand, we've got the battle to preserve orthodoxy. And there's the preserving of the halakha and the preserving of the customs of orthodoxy. Beautiful, fine, okay. But what about the spirit? What about the path of inspiration? Do you understand the problem? How do we get the path of inspiration into the modern world? Are we modern people able to receive something from our ancient tradition of this root of the spirit which is within the letter? Well, you see, number five talks about one possibility, but it's a very problematic possibility. Kabbalah. Problem with Kabbalah, for the most part, it's for the few. The Talmud in Chagigah tells us, the second chapter of Chagigah in the Talmud, both the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud, tells of the dangers of studying Kabbalah. There's the story of the four who entered Pardes, the secrets of the Torah, Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, yes, the four different levels of interpretation of the Torah, only one of whom, Rabbi Akiva, entered in peace and came out in peace. So, that doesn't seem to be the answer in itself. The Zohar speaks of the outer aspect of Torah, the inner aspect, the revealed and the hidden, but the Zohar itself is hidden. It was hidden for many centuries and it remains a hidden work. It's not the subject which is normally taught in a Ashkenazi minyan on a Shabbat afternoon, whereas in a Sfardi minyan, it might be. The Adeni minyan in Stamford Hill, where I live, they have a Shabbat afternoon, a group of gentlemen get together and they take, I think, Tikkuni Zohar and they recite it in a very melodious way. So it's quite a beautiful concept. But there is the problem. Now, there are a number of other varieties of attempts to get the spiritual in Judaism. There's the world of Chakira, the world of philosophy. For example, the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed is really a very spiritual work. A very spiritual work. The famous Jewish professor, Georges Vaida, when he was editing a volume on l'amour de Dieu, the love of God, he had a whole chapter on love of God in the Rambam's writings, and partly in the writings of Mishneh Torah and other writings, and especially in Moreh Nebuchim, Guide for the Perplexed, especially at the end of the work. Intense, intense love of God coming through philosophical thinking, which leads one to a very intense spiritual way of looking at the world. So then we have an offshoot of the Kabbalah is the Musa movement as well, where we also have, with concern about how one behaves and an intense self-criticism, also part of this tradition of looking for the spirit. The Navaradok Musa movement, tremendously intense, iconoclastic, and very, very remarkable intellectual and spiritual movement. But we are looking at Hasidism. And number six, we have revealing a path of peace. You said about the four who entered Pardes, the Jerusalem Talmud says Rabbi Akiva entered in peace and came out in peace. The Babylonian Talmud just says he came out in peace. But the Jerusalem Talmud added a crucial phrase. He entered in peace and came out in peace. Now, what is this path of peace? What I'm suggesting here is that this is the path that Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, he discovered a way of communicating the inner dimension of Judaism in a way which is a path of peace rather than the opposite. Now, what do you mean by a path of peace and the opposite? Let's have a look at number seven. There are two kinds of spirituality. I mean, the whole, you know, we could have a wonderful discussion, what is spirituality? And each person, you know, could write on a, you know, a piece of paper what they think spirituality is, and we could stop the whole lecture and just have a discussion about that, and it would be an extremely fruitful experience for me, certainly, to understand together what do we mean by the spiritual. But let me give you a simple typology. There's one kind of spirituality which leads away from the world. Away from the world. Towards God, towards the divine. Away. The world doesn't matter. Life doesn't matter. Godliness. It might include asceticism. That was one of the responses of Ben Azai, one of the four who entered Pardes. Well, Ben Azai had not wanted to, even before the story of entering Pardes, Ben Azai didn't want to get married. He wanted his nafshi choshka b'Torah. He desires Torah. He doesn't want to be distracted by marriage. Ben Zoma, another one of the four who entered Pardes, he also, either he was married and he got divorced or he never got married. He couldn't face the worldliness of life. He wanted godliness. He had entered the spiritual realm and he just wanted the divine. He wanted the spiritual. That was his understanding of spirituality, away from the world. Whereas on the other hand, there's a kind of spirituality which leads into the world. Midrash Tanchuma tells us that the goal of existence is Nitaveh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Liot Lo Dira B'Tachtonim, a dwelling. God wanted a dwelling in the lower world. Now, a dwelling, if you move into a new home, after a few alterations with the builder and the decorator and this and that, and then you move your books and your computer and you do something in the garage and the garden, the home begins to express your individuality. God wanted a world in which God is expressed, in which the atmosphere of the divine is expressed. That means the world, olam, ha-olam in Hebrew, hey, ayin, lamed, mem, if you write it without the vav, ha-olam has the same letters as the word he'elem, concealment. The world is a kind of concealment of God, and we are in a physical realm where godliness is hidden. But God wanted us human beings to live in such a way that godliness is revealed. And it's revealed in our personal lives of the Jewish people, keeping the Tarayag mitzvot, the 613 mitzvot, and by the non-Jews keeping the seven Noahide laws. And in that way, there is a world in which the world has the atmosphere of the divine. In fact, the way this is explained in Hasidic teachings, that was originally the atmosphere in the Garden of Eden. Things then went wrong and we were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. But the ultimate goal is that through the keeping of the Torah in a wholesome way, by us, the Jewish people, and by the seven Noahide laws being kept by the nations of the world, we will return the world. We will go forward to an atmosphere that where the world is a garden of the divine again, that the world becomes a dwelling for God. Now that is spirituality expressed in worldliness, in the material world, in marriage, in life, in work, in everything that we do together as human beings. There is the spiritual dimension. Now that's what I'm calling here the path of peace, the path which can be taught, because the danger in Kabbalah is teaching it in such a way that it lifts the person away from the world. He suddenly aspires some kind of remote spirituality beyond human life, beyond ordinary physical life, and he gets lost somewhere out there. Whereas what the Baal Shem Tov is teaching is how to discover godliness in the world. And he taught that within daily life of Judaism, prayer, Torah study, mitzvot, And that means the whole cradle of Jewish life, Shabbat, festivals, a home, marriage, children. That's where we discover the spiritual, the contact with the divine. And in order to teach this, point nine, he emphasized Ahavat Yisrael, the concept of love of one's fellow. Because that's the real, you see, the refuah, the healing of the problem of modernity, in a way, kadma refuah lemakah, the healing came before the problem. The problem was developing at the same time, but it was in a distant, different place. In Central Europe, there was the whole problem of modernity and the whole process that Max Weber is describing and going on through into the, from the 17th century into the 18th, into the 18th and 19th century. And then we have the Baal Shem Tov in the 18th century teaching these concepts, Ahavat Yisrael. You see, Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's fellow, means that at the very beginning you have a bond with another human being, that you care about another human being. Ahavat Yisrael certainly applies to one's own spouse and one's own children, and it should be one's love to one's spouse is even more, it's more intensely so as love of one's fellow and to one's children, but also a love which overflows and which affects every other human being with whom one comes in contact. So that idea, and the idea that Rabbi Yitzchak Luria said before tefillah, before prayer in the morning in Shacharit, one should say, Hareini mekabel al atzmi, behold, behold, I accept on myself, vahavta mitzvah, vahavta lerecha kamocha, the mitzvah to love one's fellow. So Avad Yisrael, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe commented, Avad Yisrael is the gateway through which one comes closer to service of God. So serving God is not taking one out of the world, because love of one's fellow is the gateway which brings one to a wholesome service of God in the world. And that's the Hasidic nature, that you have a spirituality which doesn't take you away from other people, which we can sometimes see as the problem of intense religiosity. It means that the person is apart in some way. He wants to be apart from others. But on the contrary, when love of God, love of one's fellow is the gateway to love of God and the service of God, then one's intensity of religiosity brings one closer to others. Now, number 10 tells us about in the third generation of Hasidism, we have Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Vladi, who is incidentally the founder of Chabad, but also he wrote a book, Tanya, which is something significant for the whole Hasidic movement. And the theme that is there on the title page of Tanya, Ki karov elecha hadava me'od beficha uvilvavcha la'asoto. It is very easy to serve God in your mouth and heart and doing it and action from the Tzavim. And he also wrote the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is a wonderful code of law and reformulation of Rabbi Yosef Karo's code, taking into account all the commentaries, especially the Magen Avraham. And there we see him as an individual combining the letter and the spirit, the code of law, what to do, and the spirit, the inspiration, which helps us commit ourselves to doing it properly. Now, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1994 and whose yahrzeit is actually tonight, he broadened the reach of the inspiration of Hasidism. He said it's not just for people who identify with the Hasidic movement, people who are part of this stream of dynasties. They are wonderful people, yes. But in fact, Hasidism is for every Jew, and there are certain elements of Hasidism which are universal for every human being. His initial statement when he became the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1951, he accepted the role of Rebbe. He previously had said, the previous Rebbe has passed away, but we know what he wanted us to do. We just continue in that. We don't need to have a Rebbe. But eventually he was persuaded to accept the role of Rebbe. And his initial statement was, what is our statement? He used that word, like what we would call today a mission statement. What is our mission statement? Love of God, love of Torah, love of one's fellow. Ahavat Hashem, Ahavat HaTorah, Ahavat Yisrael. And they all interconnect. They join together. And he gave a long, complicated talk saying that you can't have one without the other. You can't think I'm going to have love of God and love of the Torah and forget about love of one's fellow. And you can't have love of one's fellow without love of God and love of Torah. You need all of them together because they all protect and bolster each other. Now, he would give fascinating discourses and talks which were listened to by a group of very, very profound thinkers in themselves. One of the leading figure is Rabbi Yoel Kahn, Zohar Gesundheit, lives in New York now. A very great scholar, and who could remember by heart everything that the Rebbe would say in a six-hour Hasidic gathering. And then his teachings would be edited by a team, and they would be given into him for final editing before publication. Now, in 1992, in Adar Rishon, the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a stroke, and he never recovered from that, and he passed away 2 years later. But his final edited discourse before that stroke, which had been edited a little while before, is a discourse on the Sedra Tetzaveh, and it begins with the words Va'ata Tetzaveh. And that discourse, by divine providence, happens to be about Jewish leadership. And particularly, we could say, Jewish leadership in the modern world, Jewish leadership in a time of fragmentation. It begins with the words Va'ata Tetzaveh, and Va'ata Tetzaveh means God is telling Moses to command about the oil and the menorah and Aaron. And in this discourse, the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked the question, why does it say Moses should command? Moses doesn't command. God commands. Moses is simply the representative, the shliach, who transmits God's commands. Moses doesn't make it up himself, as we saw the whole argument in last week's Sedra, Korach. The whole point, as far as Moses is concerned, I did not make it up. Who should be leader? That Aaron should be high priest? That Elitzophon should be this or that? I didn't make it up. It's coming from God. I'm just transmitting what God says. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says we have to reinterpret the word tetzaveh. Tetzaveh, it's true. If you look up in a Hebrew dictionary, you'll find tziva, he commanded, and the word tetzaveh means command. In the second person, imperfect. But there's another word, an Aramaic word, tzavta. Tzavta v'chibur. Tzavta means a connection. The modern Israeli word for a tank crew is hatzevet, the crew. They're all together. They're bonded together in the tank. Hashem should protect them. They are together, and that's the tzevet. So what does the verse mean? Not Moses should command. You, Moses, should connect. The role of a Jewish leader is to connect the Jewish people to God. It's to connect each individual to God. It's to connect the whole people to God. And it's to connect people to each other as well. Now, you know that there is a Kabbalistic phrase referring to Moshe. He's called Raya Mehemna, the faithful shepherd. There's a section of the Zohar which is understood to be originally from Moses, transmitted through Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And it's referring to Moses as the faithful shepherd. But the words can be translated two ways. It's either the faithful shepherd, that means the reliable shepherd, like the Midrash talks about what a wonderful shepherd Moses was, looking after the sheep before he became a leader. But there's also the shepherd who pastures faith. The Jewish leader pastures faith. He feeds us, the Jewish people, with faith. Now, why do we need faith to be passed to us, to be given to us by a leader? Surely we have faith in ourselves. There's a phrase, a famous Talmudic phrase, Yisrael ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. The Jewish people are believers, the children of believers. We have faith on our own accord. We don't need any intermediary. We don't need anyone else to help us have faith. The problem is that it's possible for a person to have faith in God in what could be called a somewhat superficial way. And this is one of the problems, in fact, of modernity as well. The Talmud, in the Ein Yaakov version of the Talmud, in Brachot, I believe, expresses a very interesting statement. It says, it's in Aramaic, Ganva apum machtata, the thief who is breaking in, Rachmana Karya, calls to God. Imagine a thief, he's breaking in, and he hears a police car outside. He says, oh, please, God, make sure it's not for me. And the police car goes off in the distance. Thank you, God. And he goes on breaking open the safe. Now, how can this be? The Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not steal. And here you have a person doing the exact opposite. That is part of the problem. That's the déracinement. That's the being uprooted. We know that this is against the Torah. Nonetheless, the person does it, even though he doesn't claim to be a secular intellectual who doesn't believe in God or doesn't believe in the creation of the world. No, he's a simple person. He has a basic belief in God, but nonetheless, he can't control himself. What's the role of the leader? To bring that emunah bipnimiyut, that it should be in an inner way within the person, that we really live up to faith, that we have a Jewish faith and that we should live up to God in that. And so there we have, that's the teaching, basic teaching of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's last discourse about the role of Moshe and the role of the Moshe through the ages. And ultimately that is helping us to understand what is the fruit of Hasidic thought, that we should try to draw this emunah, this faith in a pnimiyut within our souls, that it affects our actions, our words, and our thoughts. And so the Lubavitcher Rebbe's impetus that each Jew should help others become more observant, which is a very famous concept, the whole guidance of the 10 mitzvah campaigns, helps each person understand more the inner meaning of the mitzvot. I was discussing today with an educator, what does it mean when a young boy, 17 years old, from the yeshiva, not very far away from the Chabad yeshiva, he goes on a Friday afternoon to some Jewish business, whether it's in Golders Green or in Bond Street or wherever, and he asks a gentleman to put on tefillin. And this person might be an older man who for many years hasn't managed to put on tefillin, and the man puts on tefillin and suddenly bursts into tears. Now that happens quite often. What does that mean for this yeshiva bocher tomorrow morning when he himself is going to put on, the next time he's going to put on tefillin, what does that mean to him? It means that tefillin is something significant. The mitzvot of the Torah are something significant. They're not just mitzvot anashim elumada. They're not just something done by habit. They are something which connect us together with God. And that word mitzvah, like the word tzavta v'chibur, a bond with God, a connection with God. So now we can conclude by considering Professor Dan's question. Why has Hasidism survived? Because it's relevant. Because it makes others into brothers. There was a whole way of looking at the world straight after the Holocaust where the very Orthodox people, they couldn't relate to the people who weren't so Orthodox, who weren't Orthodox at all. They said, we've got to keep together. We, the Shomer Shabbos people, the this, the that. But no, we have to be able to see every single Jew as a brother and a sister. And in that way, we're reversing the negative aspect of modernity while retaining its positive aspect. Modernity, I suggest, plus Hasidism it should be, is a healthy way to make a divine dwelling in the world, combining the letter and the spirit for the Jewish people and all humanity. Oh. 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 question? Yes?
So what is the difference between a Shomer Shabbat Jew and a Chassid Jew?
And a...
Chassid, what you call a Chassid Jew?
There's absolutely no difference, except that in the case of one, you see, a Shomer Shabbat Jew could be that he knows what the rules of Shabbat are and he keeps those rules. But he may also study Talmud and have a very deep understanding of what the laws of Shabbat are. And he may also study further books in giving him a sense of the spirituality of Shabbat, so that the more he studies, the more he learns, and the more he thinks about, Shabbat becomes more and more a transformative experience for him every week. For example, in prayer. Now, prayer can be something which takes place in a minyan, in a regular way, and it takes, you know, on a Shabbat morning, let's say it's a two-hour process with a nice drasha by the rabbi, and then a kiddush. It's a very nice experience. But there are some people for whom the prayer on Shabbat is itself an entire journey. And in order, I knew Rabbi Mendel Futterfass, whose yahrzeit is the fourth of Tammuz. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, his yahrzeit's the third of Tammuz, and his great chassid, Rabbi Mendel Futterfass, who I had the zchut to learn from, his is the next day, the fourth of Tammuz. Now, Rabbi Mendel would come to the Lubavitch shul at 9 o'clock in the morning. 9 o'clock in the morning, we daven late. But 9 o'clock in the morning is the time of a Hasidic shir, a shir in Hasidic teachings. He would be there at the shir, a group of men would be there learning in Yiddish, there would be another group learning in English, and he would be there and he would be listening and making points, inspiring others. Then would begin the regular Shabbos davening, and it would go step by step to Kriyat HaTorah and so on. And meanwhile, he would be sitting with a Tanya in his hand, studying further himself. Now, there's a whole question, Tfilah B'Tzivah, there's a question anyway, because it's after this month, Tfilah, lots of halachic questions, but that's the Hasidic movement. Now, at the end of Shmirat Shabbat, at the end of Ta'amei HaMinhagim, it's got a whole section about this, davening late, davening early. Now, at the end of the davening, when everyone's going down to the Kiddush, Reb Mendel would start davening. Now, there's a famous Hasidic saying, which takes us back a few years, but maybe we can remember this social or technological situation. If you are sending a letter and you catch the post, then a single stamp, first class, second class, a single stamp is enough and your letter catches the post. But if you've missed the post, you have to send a telegram. This is before email. You have to send a telegram. And in a telegram, you have to pay for every word. Reb Mendel's davening was paying for every word. You could hear it in the most inspiring way. Baruch Shama V'Hoyah Ha'olam. Incredibly powerful and moving. And children, boys of 13, 14, would come to the shul and stand in a place where he couldn't see them just to overhear the way he was davening. It was something incredibly moving. So that's the difference for a person who is entering into that extra dimension of spirituality. Now, I believe that there are ways for that to be communicated within a regular Orthodox synagogue like this, and people could learn a little bit more about the meaning of the davening and take that to heart, where man and woman, and to be able to experience davening as a very intimate connection with God.
Thank you.
Yes?
You conclude at 16 that modernity plus Hasidism is a healthy way to make a divine dwelling in the world. And in order to do that, the Chabad movement has gone out with a missionary capacity to try and bring mitzvot to other Jews. What about the rest of the Hasidic world on your diagram here? they are completely insular and apparently reject other sects or other Hasidim and will not accept them.
Well, you see, the point is that the other Hasidic groups, for the most part, are strongly emphasized by a philosophy which we could call the Haredi philosophy, which Chabad is also part of. Only they thought that the way to protect the Haredi level, the small print of the halakha, is by being an enclave. What Lubavitch is trying to teach is that if you learn the Hasidic teachings, you don't have to be an enclave. You can have a very spiritual life in Beijing, running a Chabad house and helping Israeli businessmen who come there to put on tefillin and appreciate the richness of being a Jew. Now, Chabad.
What is the value then? Excuse me. What is the value then of the other Hasidic groups, other than a perpetuation of a power base?
It does have a certain positive spirituality, which is something genuine. And the fact that it's got an enclave dimension, as I write in my book, the first chapter in my book, Hasidism Beyond Modernity, the first chapter is called Hippie in the Mikveh. So why is that chapter called Hippie in the Mikveh? Because I once brought a hippie, a man with long hair who'd been in an ashram in India. So he was staying in my home for Shabbat. So I thought it would be a nice thing for him to come to the mikveh on the eve of Shabbat and experience the transition into the holiness of Shabbat. So he goes to the mikveh. He stands in the mikveh with his long hair, probably meditating or something. The man who owned the mikveh, Alav HaShalom, actually, you should have a zir, a Gan Eden. Anyway, he says to me, who brought that person? Did you bring that person? I said, yeah. I don't want him in the mikveh, but he's Jewish. I don't want him here. I don't want my children to see him. Look, they might see him in the street. Yeah, but the mikveh is a holy place. I want him here. I don't want this kind of person. All right, so he had a little, you know, he didn't show this in any way to the gentleman in the mikveh. He was just telling me, it's my fault that he's done. However, the Vision Sereba came to town a week or two later. And this young man, he wants to see the sights. He's heard that there's a Vision Sereba in town. He wants to come and see the Vision Sereba. And with his long hair and a little yarmulke perched on top, he goes to see the Vision Sereba, and he's standing right up close to the Vision Sereba. Now, if you imagine like a tish, you know, with a Hasidic Rebbe, it would be extremely easy for the Rebbe to give like a little nod or something and some people to sort of shoulder him out of the way, and he would be, you know, moved further back. But the Vision Sereba did not do that at all. The Vision Sereba was very happy that this hippie-looking person should be standing at his tish, listening to the Yiddish things that he was saying, which he couldn't understand one word of, but he understood the neshama, versteht, the neshama does understand. So we believe, and that's what I claim in this article, that there is a gradual transformation taking place in many of these groups. Indications of this, from an academic point of view, is that when you look at the Haredi press, almost every issue, there's some kind of story about a person who became a Baal Tshuva. Now, 50 years ago, that wasn't the direction that people were thinking. We are the people who are the descendants of the people who died in the Shoah, Hashem Yidrosh Damom, and we are going to preserve Judaism, and all the people, the friar, you know, it's like a different world, and we are separate. But suddenly, they appreciate, rightly, that a Jew starts being from, and it's a meaningful thing. Another step is to appreciate the Jew, even if he doesn't become from. So that's another step. In Tanya, chapter 32, which talks about how one should love every Jew, It speaks about how a Jew who is far away from keeping mitzvah, you should love that person and try to get him to keep more mitzvot and learn Torah. Ve'im loy, and if you didn't manage, if he doesn't start keeping Torah and he doesn't start doing the mitzvot, loy hivsid tzcha avat reim, you haven't lost the reward of love of your fellow. So even if he didn't change, you still have a relationship with that person. So that's a matter of appreciating each individual.
It could be applied the other way around as well, that we should actually love the Hasidic groups, notwithstanding the fact that they're insular.
I think that's a very good point. That's a very good point.
On last Sunday, I was at the demonstration against the Al-Quds demonstration in town. On the other side, and with the people waving the Hezbollah flag, were a number, and I prepare to accept they are a minority of a minority, a number of our Hasidic brothers. Where does their love of their fellow Jew fit into this model?
I believe they're totally muddled up. And although their keeping of Shabbat might be faultless, their relationship with the rest of the Jewish people is very problematic, especially with the State of Israel, and not only the not-frum people in Israel, but the frum people in Israel, because they maintain that it is the frum Zionists who cause all the split. So I think they're completely confused, but I think that there are many people who are confused, and we have to be able to see beyond that confusion, as you said. If there is a way to change their politics, then that would be wonderful. But if they need just help as a human being, then we should try to help them. And the biggest thing, which I believe could be the most effective thing, is to try to attract them to the study of Hasidic teachings. Because by studying Hasidic teachings, they realize that every single Jew, including everyone in the Israeli army, who the Lubavitcher Rebbe called tzaddikim gemurim, complete tzaddikim, because they risk their lives for the well-being of their fellow Jews, everyone is a significant person, and that they should feel that. That will come, I believe, through the study of Hasidic teachings. So there are institutions in Chabad, in this country, in Jerusalem, in America, where they try to encourage this kind of Hasidic Jew to study Hasidic teachings and be able to imbibe this idea of genuine Ahavat Israel.
But they're a faction from within Satmar itself.
They are a faction in Satmar. In fact, when they first marched with the PLO back in the 1970s, the Satmar Ruv, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, Zichron Lebracha, said, "I am not with them, b'zeh u'b'bah. I'm not with them in this world and nor in the world to come." He completely rejected them, and in fact, they were refused entry to the Satmar school, so they set up their own schools. But it's a painful passion. It's very painful, and whenever I attend one of these demonstrations, it's very upsetting. But nonetheless... They're making an error, and one can see where the error is. And it is, in fact, I was just recently doing this with my class at UCL. We were doing Hasidism and Zionism. So in fact, the concern that Zionism might lead away from Orthodox Judaism was a very great concern at the beginning of the 20th century. It would be a kind of a substitute for Judaism. And then came the days and the weeks leading up to the War of Independence. And suddenly Lubavitch Hasidim start writing to Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. How should we relate to the battle which is about to take place or which is taking place? And he said, we have to help our Jewish brothers and sisters in every way, materially and spiritually. So suddenly, like a complete reversal, instead of all the histaigut, all the a negative atmosphere, a totally positive atmosphere to the Jewish war effort, and that was continued through by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, very much wanting that there should be a strong and healthy Jewish state.
Dr. Lowenthal, thank you very, very much indeed. It's been uplifting. We've gone from Heine and Weber all the way through to Tania and now Satma. We've covered a lot of different aspects on an elevated level. We've all enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.